This is 16.9 The Podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 16.9 has been covering the digital signage industry for more than 12 years, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon and into what stuff means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. You can listen to episodes online, get them off iTunes or Google Play, or subscribe using a podcast app. Whatever way you choose, they're free and there's a new one weekly. The 16.9 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported from the start by Jeremy Gavin and his team at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at ScreenFeed.com. Anyone with technical chops who uses a subway system to get around would understand that those are seriously challenging environments to put in sensitive display tech. And the UK display company Esprit Digital effectively got its start in digital signage, doing just that. If you've been in the signage market for a few years, or if you've used the subway systems in big cities like London, you'll know about the synchronized digital posters in many of the escalator sections. The most well-known are those in the London Underground, which were put in by Esprit many years ago and are still working. The company, based north of London, has built out its business from everything it learned about heat and airborne grime and ruggedization, and has since developed products for shopping mall concourses, sidewalk ad posters, and all kinds of other challenging scenarios. I spoke with CEO Peter Livesey about the roots of the company, which go back to really low-res LED signs for retail, and how the company has gone full circle and added fine-pitch indoor and outdoor LED screens to its product line. Peter, how did Esprit get started?
Oh, yeah, you're testing my memory here, Dave. Esprit was probably the first company to build display solutions for digital out of home. We started in the LED world. I used to be in the phone business, in the cellular phones. We brought mobile phones to the UK market. And I had contacts in the Far East, and one of them had a little toy, which was a dot matrix board that we turned into a screen for the windows, for shop windows. And we, little strip in color with a remote control handset. And basically the message was 24 hours advertising from where it matters most, your own shop window. And that cost you £1 a day for as long or as short as you wanted it.
So wait a minute, you were in on the ground floor of the wireless phone business and you decided to go into LED screen advertising instead?
Nearly. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like that. Who made the money in the phone business was, after the crash of 87, was the people who had money to open lots of shops very quickly. So the Carphone warehouses, the Dixons, and the big players came in with multiple shops and really cleaned up, because the financial model was reversed from all the money being in the handset. So I don't know if you remember, but your phone used to cost you a couple of grand. And then overnight, all the big manufacturers got together and said, no, we're giving the handsets away and we're going to sign everyone up to these contracts. And they started off at 2 years, I think, and then the rest is history. They made all the money.
Okay. So you didn't blow it?
No, not entirely.
All right. So back to the start.
My friends do laugh about it all the time still, unfortunately.
So you effectively were getting into an advertising business then?
Well, we've always been design, build, and support of bespoke hardware. I mean, quite literally, for any environment, anywhere in the world, and then we support it for life. So that's our mantra, if you like. We don't sell ads, and we don't own the software, so we don't compete with many people.
Okay.
We're literally all about making the solutions more and more robust and more suitable for literally any kind of environment you can imagine.
So it was more enabling technology.
Definitely.
Okay. Imagine you guys came on the radar to me when the cascading screens started going in the escalator systems in the London Underground. Was that kind of the first landmark project for the company?
I would say so. Yeah, that was the first time we'd worked with LCD. At the turn of the century, we started looking this new technology, found that it had a lot of properties that we liked. And the London Underground was one of the very first people that we approached with the idea of changing their paper to screens.
Ah.
Process, let me tell you.
I remember seeing that and thinking that must be enormously challenging. And at that time, I was doing screens and elevators, which is enormously challenging. But man, that to get them all to sync to you know, in that environment with the heat and the dust and the everything that's flying, for that to be your first big project in LCD, that was like
crazy.
That was learning to sprint before you learn how, or before you can walk.
I mean, quite literally, that was, you know, 15 years ago. And if I tell you that was the hardest project we're ever going to do, and it was the first project. So, yes, it was completely back to front, unfortunately. But it worked out. And there's loads of stories around it. But the main ones, the main take-homes, if you like, from that project was we really moved the envelope on the technical side. But also the ad sales guys moved it in on the digital out of home side. So it was a genuine triple win. So the public got a nice makeover. So on their daily commute, they were looking at something more than just the floor or some static ads that have been defaced, and they got some, you know, live, really interesting content to look at. So that was a win, especially for TfL, who own London Underground. They loved the fact that, you know, they could blow the trumpet and say, look what we've done. We've improved the, we've improved your daily commute. Then the ad agencies, brands, had this whole new shiny medium where they would never consider advertising in the past because it was just too down market on the subway. It just wasn't an environment they wanted to be associated with in any great depth. But now they had these shiny new screens to advertise on, and we got every leading brand in the world to go on there very quickly. And thirdly, the technological advances, as you say, the first thing that hits you is we call it image flow, which is the cascading images you talk about. And we launched with Rocky running up one side through all the screens, turning around at the top of the Philly Library steps, and then running down the other side through all the screens. And, you know, it was a massive wow factor in the heart of the rush hour. In the mornings, people were going around the escalators a couple of times to see the content and causing a security issue at the bottom. So we were jumping up and down delighted, but obviously the security guys weren't that thrilled with us. But that soon wore off and it became a staple. The other thing that we proved was that you didn't need to broadcast two screens, which is what we previously. We'd used the first solid state media players in each screen. So every 18 minutes, each screen on each escalator wall would ring up the central server, which coincidentally was in Toronto at the time, and ask the server, is there any new content for me? No, 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 yes. And then suddenly pull it down. And getting it to synchronize, in those days, it didn't exist, the synchronizing technology. We had to write the programs to do it. So all of these things were technological breakthroughs. And probably the hardest one was how we deal with the heat. You know, you don't consider London to be hot, but when you're three stories down, there's no air conditioning, you've got 100 screens on a wall, and you've got 100,000 people at Oxford Circus in the rush hour for two or three hours a day, you got a lot of heat down there. So we had to build a sealed environment for the technology, to house all the technology, the screens, the media players, obviously the power supplies. So we came up with some very sophisticated cooling technology, which we still use, which is still it still forms a major part of our offering, is how do we keep these environments clean, dust-free, zero ingress. And as I was telling you before, we had to make sure that they not only were completely waterproof, but also fireproof. So they have to be able to burn for an hour with zero emission. Because in the event of a disaster on the tube, on the underground, the first thing they do is lock the escalators down. Everyone troops out and they reckon they can clear the busiest station inside 40 minutes as a maximum. So that gives everyone a chance. The last thing they need is people trudging up the escalators and a lot of gaseous LCDs exploding on them.
So was there a moment when you're talking to TfL, and I assume the media company who was going to bankroll these things, saying, we can do this, and then walking out of the room and going back to the office and thinking, oh, we have to figure out how we can do this.
You've obviously heard this story before. Yeah, very much so. It was an American company at the time. Viacom had the initial contract. They became CBS, also American, and they're now Experian. We were pretty confident that we had a very good knowledge of LCD by then. We tested multiple technologies and multiple forms of LCD and what we could do and how we could push it. So we were confident. But when they said, you know, you're going to have to put your money where your mouth is and do the first station yourself. That's when it kind of hits us that if it didn't work, they weren't going to pay for it that month. If it didn't work for 97% of the available screen hours from 6 a.m. to midnight, if 97%, you know, of the time had to work. So we made it work. In fact, it worked even more. It was over 99% actually. They never missed a payment. And within over a year, rolled it out to another 20 stations in London, and thereafter various other cities around Europe, and Vienna, Prague, Oslo. So the technology was kind of become
a standard now, has it not? In major transport systems with deep escalator systems.
Yeah, they don't have to be that deep, but they can be stairs. You know, you've got to get downstairs somehow, and you've got a lot of time while you're doing it. You can't smoke. Most of the time, the phones don't work down there. People don't like making eye contact, especially early in the morning. So we give them a welcome distraction. Lots of reasons to look at screens.
Mm-hmm. And how many times now have, let's say, in your oldest installations, have you refreshed the screens?
No, we haven't. That's really? One of the things we're most proud of, is that there's over 2,000 screens on the London Underground today that were installed between 2005 and 2006.
Really? So
they're still working 18 hours a day. They should have been refreshed after 3 years. That was the warranty we gave them.
Yeah.
We didn't know any better. But the solution is completely robust. We still get them back from time to time. We open them up and the inside's clean as a whistle.
Right. So you would have hot spares that you can, you know, put in.
No. No, we don't. There's no maintenance allowed on site. It's a full swap out if there's ever a problem.
Huh. Interesting. So your company has since gone on to do a lot of other work. You're doing a lot of mall displays, which I think you guys call, and I would call, digital posters.
Yeah.
Was that because you were already working with media companies like Viacom/CBS/ whatever they're called now, Outfront or something, that's what they wanted to do? That was the next market for them or vertical for them?
Yeah. Well, obviously we blitzed the metros, went around the world with that, with the DEPs, as they're called, digital escalator panels, mm-hmm. with success. We then put a lot of that same technology into airports because they have very similar high specification requirements. So we did a lot of airports. In fact, we've just refreshed Heathrow after 10 years. So all the screens from the Heathrow Express train up into each of the five terminals. So lifts, escalators, walkways, they're all being refreshed at the moment. I did a lot of airports around the world, including some in India, funny enough. And then the malls came on stream and started thinking about monetizing, you know, the central spaces. And we've done a lot of mall deployments now around the globe. Particularly the newest ones are all in the Middle East, and they're all out doing each other with the most incredible stuff. So typically they'd have a network of totems, mostly double-sided, large format, so 65, 75, 85 inch in a nice housing that kind of reflects their look and feel that we sit with them, we design with them. They can have it literally in any format, in any material. And then we spec it up from there, whether it's got to have audience measurement in eye beacons. You know, there's a million options that they can put in these boxes, and then they can use them for either pure play advertising, as say a Westfield does, which, you know, is 100% advertising, and then they have different kiosks for wayfinding applications, and then they also have LEDs normally on the bulkheads or hanging, and these amazing spectaculars that large format LEDs that kind of turn on a big rectangle. I don't know if you've seen them in the empty wells. They're really, really popular. And our latest addition, these LED tiles that curl round columns. So literally the tile bends back on itself, so there's almost no shape or space where we can't install these things. And using the image flow, the synchronizing technology, you can have a wow effect with maybe 6 to 10 columns in a line and have the adverts kind of bouncing around them, cross them, in between them. Really nice.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting that you mentioned that you started with very rudimentary LED display way back when, and now you have found yourself kind of going back to LED now that the technology has advanced so much in terms of pixel pitch and everything else. Do you see it replacing a lot of what's now done with LCD once you get up to a certain size?
Yeah, it's about the viewing distance normally. LCD still works very good up close and personal. So if you're going to go up and touch a screen, interact with it, walk immediately past it, then LCD is still the route to go. The definitions are still hard to beat. It's any distance viewing, so a bulkhead in an overhead in a shopping mall, that's a good example where you've kind of got the choice between an old-fashioned video wall, which we were doing lots of up until about 2 or 3 years ago, and an LED, and then anything further, so any big kind of end of mall or end of airport or outside, then it tends to be LED for distance. We are, however, doing a lot of LCD for full outdoor use now. So the outdoor totems, the advertising pods outside in all conditions. So, we've just done some hurricane-proof ones in Miami, and they've been in a year. They survived last year's one, whose name escapes me, hurricane something, last year. And they were all still standing while everything else around them was completely destroyed. Done bomb-proof ones, obviously waterproof, snow-proof in Scandinavia, desert-proof ones we've done in the Middle East. So full outdoor LCD is still very popular, again, for close-up. When you're walking around a facility, going into it from a car park, public areas like that, then LCD still works really well. But if it's big, larger format, or on a wall high up, then the LED will get you the viewing distance and the wow factor that way.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit ScreenFeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
Do you see, if you go to trade shows like an ISE or Infocom or any of those ones, I am seeing companies that are mostly Chinese companies that are marketing digital poster products that are based on fine pitch LED and saying, having the same form factor as a LCD totem. Do you see those getting to a point where they can supplant LCD, or they're going to be limited by the resolution?
Yeah, I think they are going to be limited. It's a minefield out there. What Esprit Digital does, the official mission of Esprit is as a full service agnostic integrator. So we basically are not wedded to any component, any manufacturer, even the screens, and especially the LEDs. We basically take the pain away. We buy from all of the Esprit certified factories, and we're doing certification the whole time in the Far East, in Europe, and in America. We look at all available technologies and we decide what is the right technology for your solution right now for your budget. And that way we know we're making something that is really going to last. And the longevity factor is crucial, because if you're putting in an information network, you don't want to be doing that every few years. You want to be having decades of it. If you're putting in an ad network, you want to make the most amount of money you can, obviously, at least 5 and probably 10 years for each solution. So what we do with LED, which is a particularly difficult area, because whereas in LCD, there's probably only Samsung, LG, NEC, Sharp, and a couple of others that you may have heard of. In LED, there are hundreds of manufacturers in quotes. So it's a real minefield. And what we do is we take the pain away. We research the market for each application, and then we kind of build and design the subframe and design all the metalwork and the cladding, and then we go and install and we support it on site physically and also remotely. We have a network operation center in the UK that looks after tens of thousands of screens all the time, 24/7, 365, and can do some very clever stuff with our Cortex brain, which is inside each unit. The brain will control the inside temperature, will report back 24/7 on every live component within the solution, will allow us to reboot any unit remotely. So obviously we've been looking after our Westfield Australia network. There's about 1,500 large format screens down there. We can reboot a unit in Perth, Australia, instantly, just over the internet.
So you go ahead.
No, I was just saying, as a kind of an advance on that, we can even reflash a BIOS on a PC remotely now. So anything to stop the expensive site visits and inconvenience of the downtime. That's what we're all about.
So you mentioned Cortex. So essentially, it sounds like you have some sort of an ARM processor that you attach to every display unit, and you've got your own device management software that runs in parallel to whatever the content management system is?
Yeah, essentially, yes. Cortex is in its fifth iteration. It's a lifesaver for us because we tend to do, well, we do all the support on all our screens. So if customer has the insurance of having the manufacturer, in this case us, looking after their solutions in the field, wherever they may be, we've just done 20 malls in the States, and it's, if we're sending somebody in out of ours, probably two people, because it's quite big solutions and quite heavyweight machinery, etc., you know, it's an expensive business. If you can sort all that out remotely, well, then obviously it's a different financial model for you and for the customer. And the Cortex basically will manage the backlight, make sure it's not too bright or too dull. If it's, you know, if it's during the day, if it's in direct sunlight, it will manage everything automatically and will report back. So they make sure that everything is operating well within its temperature ranges. And that's the secret of keeping these things going for forever and ever.
Differentiation, I would imagine, is a challenge both for the indoor and outdoor product in that there are any number of companies selling product that at first blush, when you look at them on a trade show floor or in a showroom or whatever, they all look very nice. They all look very pretty and sleek and everything else. So how do you set yourself apart from those guys? Because I would imagine a lot of novice end users, they're buying on price and buying on, you know, bells and whistles.
Can be a foolish saving, Dave. You know, if you're buying a low-cost solution, it's a low-cost solution for a reason. They're not using the best components in there. We have we have solutions where, you know, we're bringing out at the DPAA, we'll be launching the what we're calling the 10K kiosk, $10,000 for a double-sided 65-inch fully loaded that we will warrant for, I think it's 5 years. But if they're really cheap, you know, and I've seen some much cheaper than that, you know, it's cheap for a reason. They're not going to last in the field. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to run them anything over 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, it's a foolish saving because, number one, you're not going to have as good a customer experience. The look and feel of the unit itself is not going to be as anywhere near as good. And obviously, if the screens fail or you can't update them, then the customer experience is poor. The advertisers want their money back. You're not getting across the information you want to get across. And it's going to cost you more money because you're going to be going and visiting these things regularly. Our mission, our target, and it works, is we do not visit our screens more than once in its lifetime, in its 5 years.
So if I'm an end user or I'm an integrator working with an end user, what are those things I should be looking for and what are those questions I should be asking? Because if I'm new to it, I'm looking at product A and product B and the Esprit product, and they're all running video. They all look bright enough to be in the sunshine. You know, the metalwork seems okay, but I don't know enough about metalwork to, you know, distinguish what's quality versus not. I don't know anything about ventilation.
Funny enough, you would, Dave. Anyone does. When we go on, when we do the exhibitions, and
you don't know me though. I'm stupid.
We'd put our product there, and you'd feel it, and you'd know that this is a solid unit. This is going to make my brand stand out. This is going to make my my shopping mall look better, feel better. And then you'll find a lower quality metalwork, and you'll say, okay, now I get it. It sways a bit. It's thin. You know, it's obviously not as well put together. Most of our solutions have about 83 bits of metal in, would you believe, just in a pod, in an advertising pod, because, you know, it's got to look the part. It's your front, it's the first thing people see when they approach your infrastructure, your site. Mm-hmm. So it's important. But I think if you don't skimp on the components, I mean, most of the, there's tried and trusted manufacturers. So everybody's heard of the big boys in, say, an LCD solution. And the same would apply to the PCs that go inside it, the software using to drive it. Certain power supplies we know don't last. We tend to spec our own PCs and our own power supplies. And we know that, you know, thousands of them are in the field running very happily, well within their tolerances. So that kind of thing, you can't just get from a trade show and you can't just get from your first deployment. You've got to do a lot if you're going to row your own boat. Obviously, we can help and we can advise. And if you go for an Esprit solution, then, you know, we'll sit down and we'll go through absolutely every element and show you why we're spending an extra £10 on this component over that one.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this from other manufacturers in the display business and in the hardware business who say, if we can get the potential customer to our manufacturing facility, we close them. Once we have a chance for them to have a good look around at what we do and understand how we operate and how we do things, you know, they're sold.
Yeah. And the same would apply here. We've got a facility that we can show the history of every single job we've ever done and the rationale behind it and how it's working in the field over the last 20 years. So yeah, we'd be the same. We'd be disappointed if people come here and they go away and, you know, order elsewhere, then, you know, we're doing something wrong because it almost never happens.
You are operating in one of the most expensive cities in the world. Now, granted, your manufacturing, or I guess central facility, is on the outskirts of London, I gather, but it's a very, very expensive place to be. How do you deal with that?
We're about 30 minutes north of London in a kind of a, not quite a Silicon Valley, but we're in a kind of an electronics specialist area. And the working rate's compatible with the northern cities in England. So we're not paying London rates. There's a lot of good quality, qualified labor that we can draw on when the big projects sort of stack up one after the other. And we can be very competitive. The other thing is when there's a big deployment overseas. So at the moment, let's say we did a big one in America last year and we assembled everything locally. So we flat pack the solution. If it's big unit numbers in the sort of 500 to 1,000 plus, we have assembly facilities in the destination country in the States. They were in New Jersey and San Jose. The team, the factory team leaders will go out, supervise the full assembly, do the final testing locally using local labor. Mm-hmm. And that can work really well.
Is the company privately held?
Yes.
It's your company?
Yes. Yes. There's a small group of shareholders.
Right. And how many people do you have now working for you?
Here's 35 on site and in the field. We also have a number of partners who we've worked with forever on every job, particularly in maintenance and installation, which mm-hmm. we like to keep the same people where possible.
And you scale up in manufacturing, as you mentioned,
very quickly,
when you need to.
Yeah, very quick.
And if I'm remembering correctly, it's been in the last couple of years when you've started to make more of a concerted effort to be in North America, particularly in the US, correct?
Yeah, America's always been the elephant in the room. We've always known, I've always felt that it was going to be the biggest market for digital in the world. But there were easier doors to press, you know, to push on. And because of the sheer size and scale of the country, it made it difficult to kind of attack in one go. So what we tend to do is we tend to win a trophy network and then go in on the back of that and start doing a big marketing push on the back of that. And now that we've got, you know, well, we've probably got a couple of thousand screens in the States now and that we're looking after that we've put in all over. So we've now got reference points all over the States. Yeah. We feel now's a good time to, you know, to make a push. And we've joined the DPAA. So that will be announced in the next couple of weeks just before their conference. And we're making some sizable meetings out there.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the DPAA 10K product.
10K kiosk, yes, coined by Barry Fry.
And what is that, like an officially sanctioned thing, or is that just like a goal that he set?
That's the name. That's what we're going to call the product. That's going to be its working title. It's a low-cost solution, but it's a very robust one. It's one that will really, it'll last and last. We found a way of integrating good components that we've been talking about, and also to keep the cost down in reasonable quantities as well. I mean, literally, you know, fives and tens is fine with this product.
Is that where the growth is on digital at-home advertising? Because I know there are companies, and I've been to their facility, for Stratacash making drive-through outdoor displays, and that seems to be their focus. They're not really looking at digital at-home.
Yeah, same in this country. There's people just concentrating on one particular product or product area. We don't. We do everything from a 5.5-inch ruggedized touch tablet for point of sale that we're doing in the phone shops in two or three UK technology retailers, right up to wrapping up, you know, shopping centers with, you know, mesh LED going for hundreds of meters. So we don't have any one area of specialism. We do anything to do with screens.
Is there a riddle you're still trying to solve in this space in terms of the technical challenge, whether that's dealing with direct sunlight or heating or God knows what?
Well, poor air quality, direct sunlight, especially in really hot climates. We're working in Saudi at the moment, and vandalism is another one. These are all the challenges that we faced, and we faced them, you know, hundreds of times over our history. And yeah, each particular deployment has its own quirks. And as I said, we've made all these subsurface, hurricane-proof, bomb-proof, waterproof type solutions, so we can draw from that experience.
Okay. So last question. If I am traveling about and I want to see your product in the wild, I would see it in London subway escalator wells. I would see them in Westfield malls.
Yeah, any Westfield malls in the world, all of their main malls. You'd see them in all the big airports. So Heathrow, Gatwick, Stansted, Manchester, Bristol in the UK. You'd see them in the metros in Europe. You'd see them in some of the malls. We've got malls in Europe and all the swanky new malls in the Middle East.
Swanky.
They're very swanky. they've got some great budgets for some of these properties, and they're really worth a look if you like that sort of thing.
I've been to Dubai. It's right, kind of, you know, mind wobbling.
Yeah, one thing we are getting into, and is worth a very quick plug, is our new division being launched in the next month or two. It's called EDI for Interactive. It specializes in audience measurement and guest engagement platforms, and this includes our own proprietary magic mirrors for fashion retailers, and we're very excited about that because the retail side of things has been largely ignored by Esprit up until about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. If you remember, we started the business doing all retailers for the shop windows, and then we kind of left it alone for a good few years. Now, in-house retail technology team have come up with some wonderful solutions and ways to get the public excited about going into shops again, because obviously there's a big fight on their hands with all things going online and our friends at Amazon, and it's time for the fight back. And one of the ways of doing that is to keep people amused when they're in the shops, get them a good experience, get them a quick experience when the shop staff are busy, and to promote products, you know, in a cool new way.
All right. Very interesting. Thanks so much for taking the time with me.
My pleasure, Dave.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around for more than 2 years. You can click around the archive and find more than 100 conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9 at 16-9.net. There are now more than 6,000 posts in there about this industry. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside beautiful, amazing Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.